Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. We respectfully submit that defendant appellant Spencer Harris is entitled to a new trial because of numerous evidentiary errors at the district court. Due to those evidentiary errors, the government was allowed to paint Harris before the jury as a career drug dealer, making the focus of the trial less on the actual charges and crimes charged in the indictment and more on Harris's alleged occupation as a drug dealer. These errors, whether viewed individually or in their totality, unfairly prejudiced Harris and denied him a fair trial. First, the district court erred in allowing the government to introduce evidence of Harris's involvement in a number of unrelated, uncharged drug transactions between he and Troy Powers and Mario Brown. The charges against Harris stem from three discrete events. There was two controlled drug purchases, one on June 22nd and the other on June 29th, 2006. And a third event was the subsequent search that occurred on July 6, 2006. Despite the fact that the charges all centered around these discrete events, the court allowed the government to introduce evidence concerning a series of unrelated drug transactions that occurred in 2004 and 2005 between appellant Harris and Mario Brown and Troy Powers. And neither Powers nor Brown had anything to do whatsoever with this case. For example, Powers was allowed to recount how he had on at least seven occasions purchased thousands of dollars worth of cocaine from Harris. And Brown was allowed to describe how he purchased cocaine from Harris on approximately 10 different occasions in 2004 and early 2005. There was also other testimony regarding Powers and Brown. For example, David Haynes, who was the individual who cooperated with the government in the controlled buys, was allowed to testify that Harris had allegedly told him that he sold $15,000 worth of cocaine to Brown on a weekly basis.
Well, a lot of this testimony was admitted because on the question of Harris's prior drug deals and being probative on the issue of whether he intended to distribute the drugs found at his residence.
That's correct. The evidence, the district court below, the government argued that the evidence went towards to establish Harris's intent to distribute the drugs that were found during the July 6th search of his apartment and his girlfriend's apartment. However, because intent is almost always an issue, and because there's a fine line between propensity and intent, this court has made clear that the government must affirmatively show why a particular prior act somehow establishes the more forward-looking factor or the intent to commit the future crime. Before the district court and here, however, the government did not meet that burden. The government merely argued that in this instance of a specific intent crime, as the case here, the government is sometimes allowed to introduce evidence of prior acts to show intent. But other than merely reciting the general rule, the government never articulated a reason why this evidence tended to show that Harris intended to distribute the drugs that were uncovered in July of 2006.
Hadn't Harris told Haynes about his arrangement with Brown and some difficulty that arose out of it, and talked about something about feeling that Brown thought he set him up or something like that?
Yes, Your Honor. There was not only was there testimony from Brown and Powers. There were several other fact witnesses who were allowed to testify about Harris's alleged dealings with Brown and Powers, and one of those was David Haynes, who testified that I believe it was Brown was allegedly upset at Harris for setting him up or turning him into the police. And it was just I believe the purpose of that testimony was to establish some kind of motive for Harris owning or possessing a firearm to protect himself if Brown later came in.
Related to drug deal.
Yes, that was the purpose behind that. Although the government never argued that was the purpose.
Do you concede that Haynes' testimony regarding his prior drug deals with Harris provides a context for his testimony regarding the two drug deals that Mr. Harris was charged with? In other words, goes to the issue of explaining his relationship to Mr. Harris?
No, Your Honor. The first, if there was any reason or any need to explain the history between Harris and Haynes, that could have been done in a much different way than it was here. Here, Haynes was allowed to testify that he, over a course of approximately 2004 up to 2006, he purchased literally hundreds of transactions between he and Harris. He testified that over a 9-month period, he purchased two to three times a day. He purchased crack cocaine from Harris. So if we believe his testimony, he testified over 800 cocaine transactions between he and Harris, and there's no need for that. And the
what was suggested? I mean, after the court said that this testimony was would come in, did defense counsel say, this 800 is a little excessive? Perhaps the number should be smaller. Doing that prejudice versus probative value analysis?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is, and it's the same story with Powers and Brown, the evidence changed. It was a moving target. The only time that it came out that there were 800 alleged transactions was actually during the testimony at trial. The government explained that they were going to introduce evidence regarding the history and prior drug transactions between Harris and Haynes. But Haynes' testimony, if you look at his testimony at trial, first he says, I purchased drugs from Harris 3 to 4 times. Then the government asked him, well, how'd you do it? Wasn't it more than 3 or 4 times? And then all of a sudden it was 2 to 3 times a day over a 9-month period. So suddenly it went from 3 to 4 times to over 800 times.
Were objections made when that happened, was there any questioning by defense counsel up front before he testified? What would be the number of times he testified to?
There wasn't an examination of either Powers, Brown, or Haynes up front, and defense counsel objected with filed a motion in limine beforehand, and then had continuing objections at trial.
Okay. So when the 800 number came out, that there was an objection, or that was just a standing objection?
It was just a standing continuing objection. There wasn't a specific objection to now all of a sudden it's 800. It was it was truly a moving target here, and the same with Powers testified. I started buying drugs from Harris in 2004. Then he said it was in 2003. Then later he said it was in 2005. And that also goes to not only should the evidence, none of this evidence should have come in under 404B, but that fact that I'm discussing now as far as the ambiguity of the testimony, also necessitates that it should not have come in because it wasn't reliable. The government has to show that the evidence would have supported a jury finding or conclusion that the prior conduct had in fact occurred. But when you look at it, the evidence was ambiguous, and all three witnesses, Powers, Brown, and Haynes, were biased. Powers and Brown were both in prison approximately a year before the first relevant transaction in this case. Both were in prison at the time they testified, and both were testifying pursuant to an agreement with the government to get a reduced sentence. Haynes is clearly biased. He's pulled over by the police. They find he's on parole. He gets pulled over by the police. They find crack in his child's car seat. They find marijuana in his car. So what's he do? Hey, I can offer up Harris for you. And suddenly he has a ton of information about Harris. Clearly another biased witness, which...
And did all that come out before the jury, all these facts that you're laying out about the baby and they were both in jail and all these things that came out during...
It did come out. Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Paul?
May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. We advance several theories of admissibility in our brief for this evidence. And especially in light of this court's recent Taylor case, we really want to focus today on what we think is the clearest cut theory of admissibility, and that's a straightforward 404B analysis. It isn't the case here, as defense counsel just represented, that it's our position that any time there's a specific intent crime, the government is allowed to introduce prior distributions. That's not what happened here. The government introduced this evidence in response to particular theories of defense as advanced by defense counsel. One of those theories was that although the defendant admitted that he was present during these controlled buys, admitted that he stayed in the Green Tree residence behind this locked door with his girlfriend, admitted that he or didn't contest that he lived at the other residence, that in fact he was just an innocent bystander in this entire thing. He was set up by David Haynes. He didn't do any of it. It was all a big mistake, overzealous law enforcement. The other is, but if you do find that I did possess the drugs that were found at Green Tree and that were found in my primary residence, those were just user amounts. That was a personal use amount. I didn't intend to distribute them.
But the defense didn't request mere possession instructions.
The defense didn't do that. But that was clearly a defense theory. And this case, I think, is a perfect example for this court of how this oftentimes plays out for the government. Because defense counsel are getting more savvy. We've all read the opinions out of this court that speak to the issue of specific intent and the government's being prohibited from introducing this kind of evidence if the only defense is we're just going to put the government to its burden of proof here. We're just going to challenge, you know, whether or not they prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So prior to trial, the government files its notice on the 404B, and the defense responds with, oh, wait a minute, you don't get to put this in because most likely, and those were the exact words in their motion to eliminate, most likely we won't be raising any kind of issue as to the defendant's intent. Well, again, the defense doesn't tell us ahead of time exactly what they're going to do, and oftentimes the theory of defense is propounded through the cross-examination of the government's witnesses and then crystallized in the closing, and that's exactly what happened here. And so if we're, you know, if our hands are tied on the front end because defense counsel is unwilling to articulate or commit to a particular theory of defense, and that theory of defense isn't crystallized till closing, as it was here, then we don't have any opportunity to rebut that in our case. And
well,
so
I want you, you're just about done with that thought, because I want to ask you, so I understand why the government wanted to admit this evidence. Okay. My question is, why did the jury have to hear about hundreds of occasions? I mean, up to 800 occasions, and they heard from Brown. I mean, when you look at the probative versus prejudice standard, I mean, I think 800 is a lot. Why wasn't it sufficient to just say he'd done it before, over a period of time, some other things that could have come out? And it sounds like, and I don't know if counsel's correct, after he said it was three or four times, the government sought to find out the full scope of the relationship and the number of times. That just seems excessive to me.
Well, that's an absolutely fair question, and I think it is the pivotal question in this case, is how much is too much.
Right.
And I think that, you know, defense counsel does a very effective job in his brief and here today in terms of characterizing this as over 800 drug transactions. When I first read that in his brief, it's a startling number. But what I think is important is I think it's important to realize that that isn't really an accurate characterization of how this evidence came out. David Haynes, and this is, I think it's important to look at the actual transcript pages, which are 318 to 321, I think. But David Haynes never testified there were 800, never said that number. He certainly never went into detail about 800 prior transactions. What he said was, I first met the defendant in 2004. On that occasion, the defendant sold me $250 worth of crack, which was a quarter ounce. He, at that point, provided me with his cell phone number and said, from now on, when you want to buy drugs, just go ahead and give me a call on my cell. The defendant, or David Haynes, testified that he started to do that 2 to 3 times a week, and he would purchase the same amount, the quarter ounce, for the same amount of money, $250. So he's a small-time drug dealer, and he's getting small amounts from the defendant.
Go ahead, finish, because, I mean, you're assuming maybe the jury can't multiply.
Well, I do want to get to that, Your Honor. And But I want to make sure that we all understand exactly what David Haynes testified to first. Then he said he went to prison for 9 months. When he got out of prison, 3 days later, he recontacted the defendant. And at this time, he started calling the defendant up to 2 to 3 times a day, again purchasing that very small amount of crack, the quarter ounce, for $250. We're not suggesting that the jury can't multiply. What we're saying is, when you look at the way in which this evidence came out, it really was far more benign than a picture, and more probative than a picture that is painted as if David Haynes got on the stand and said, "I want you to know that this happened 850 times prior
to
this."
I'm saying 2 or 3 times a day over more than a year period. I mean, that's a lot of.
It is a lot.
The magic number 800 wasn't said, but 2 or 3 times a day for a year, and then the other time over that 9 month time, that's a lot. And normally in the analysis of the prejudice versus the probative value, the court tries to do something to certainly be balanced and give the government sufficient evidence to deal with this question, but this just seemed very excessive to me.
And I would like, Judge Williams, I do think that's a valid point. I want to make sure that we really look at the probative value of this evidence, because, of course, it is a balancing test. And the test is whether or not the probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. And so we really have to look at the probative value here. The evidence is highly probative because it shows, and it was important to show, that they had this continuous dealing with one another, because it shows the comfort level between the two. It shows the level of trust between the two. It explains why David Haynes, on a moment's notice, could pick up the cell phone, call the defendant, say no more than, I'm popping over, I'm coming by. Find out from the defendant, are you at Green Tree, or are you at your primary residence? I'm going to pop over. Nothing more was said on those cell phone
calls. And even during the transaction, nothing was said.
Exactly, right? Judge Tinder. During the transaction, he shows up. We have the audio tape. We have the videotape. The videotape shows almost nothing. It's weird angles, and you see the sky and you see the ground, but you don't ever see a hand-to-hand. But in the audio tape, it doesn't sound like there's a drug deal going on. There is no discussion, unless it's a very veiled, cryptic, quick discussion that the audio doesn't pick up. There's no discussion of drug dealing. There's no discussion of price. There's no discussion of amount. Well, how could all that have happened? It happened because for a long period of time, or a significant period of time, for several times a day, near the end, these two would engage in the exact same drug transaction over and over and over again.
So then why couldn't just the more recent activity be admitted?
It's certainly
if you're talking about, I understand, but before he was in jail, maybe that could have been excluded, and maybe just the more recent, you know, in the last month, 2 or 3 times a day or something.
Absolutely, the court could have drawn the line at a different place. I mean, we're not disputing that. And that's, you know, the question is whether or not Judge Scott abused her discretion in terms of where she drew that line. I also want to, one issue that you or question you raised before Judge Williams in response to defense counsel's argument, was you wanted to know exactly how this played out with respect to the prosecutor's questioning. And what happened was David Haynes was a little bit cryptic about, he said, 2 or 3 times in response to the prosecutor's question, how often was this occurring? And the prosecutor was merely clarifying, what do you mean, 2 or 3 times a month, a week, a day? So it wasn't as if the prosecutor was trying to get in front of the jury some large amount and really pushing the witness to say that. The prosecutor was just asking a clarifying question. But it's absolutely a fair comment to say the judge could have drawn the line someplace else here. The judge could have said, as you point out, Judge Williams, let's look at only after you got out of jail or 3 months before. But the issue is whether or not this was an abuse of discretion. And the district court was careful to issue the limiting instructions and, in fact, read to the jury an expanded limiting instruction and final instructions that was tendered by defense counsel at the instruction conference. She was very careful. She did exclude other evidence. And we just don't think, in balance, this wasn't inflammatory. This wasn't so prejudicial. It wasn't as if we introduced evidence that the defendant had killed someone in the past or kidnapped someone. As the judge found, look, the fact that the entire case is about drug dealing between these two and about the defendant's possession of drugs, that mitigates the prejudicial impact of this other evidence that we're putting in. So then the question becomes, well, where do you draw the line in terms of time? Are suddenly the jurors going to be overly concerned if it's 6 months instead of a year, or a year instead of 2 years? And, you know, this court may decide that to draw that line differently.
All right. And then one other question. Since he was convicted of distributing crack cocaine, do you agree this case should be remanded in light of our decision in Taylor?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because I've actually given this a lot of thought. And I think that there's a difference between a defendant who raises the Kimbrough issue for the first time on appeal. I do understand the way that the Taylor remand works, and it's similar to the Palladino remand mm-hmm. post-Booker. But in this particular situation, Kimbrough, that opinion was issued prior to the reply brief in this case, and that issue was never brought up. I do think that the waiver principle should still operate with this court, even if defendants are allowed to have a remand under plain error when the issue is raised on appeal. I think there's, if I may continue, even though my time's up, I think there's another issue to be explored here, too, and I'm not sure that this court or any other court in the country has definitively resolved the issue whether or not Kimbrough comes into play in a career offender context. And I believe that this defendant didn't focus on, I don't have the sentencing transcript, but I believe that this defendant was sentenced as a career offender, and I'm not sure that that issue has been definitively decided. Now, Kimbrough talks about the crack versus cocaine ratio in sentencing as a whole affecting a guideline range, and I think, you know, even in the career offender context, the career offender guideline is somewhat driven by that disparity because you look at the maximum statutory maximum and then that drives the guideline range. So I think there is a reasonable argument to be made that even in a career offender context, those cases may need to be remanded. But again, there's still the issue of whether or not that was waived before this court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How much time? Mr. Rooney, you have about a minute.
Can you address your view of Taylor and Kimbrough and the fact that Kimbrough was out before your reply, and so what's your position on whether this should be remanded back and what's the effect of the career criminal designation?
I'll be honest, I didn't realize that the case was out when I filed my reply brief. I don't think that should waiver should apply here, though, based on that. As far as the career offender, my understanding is he was not, based on the sentencing guidelines, I mean, based on the sentencing transcript, he was not sentenced as a career offender, but I may be wrong on that. As far as the audio and videotapes, there was this wasn't the case where there was some kind of code or veiled language being used. This was a case where the audio and videotapes just simply didn't pick up everything. And there's no evidence from the tapes that they were using some sort of hidden code or...
it was just sort of traditional, I don't want to say, but at least customary that that's what it was. The same amount of money, same amount of cocaine, right?
But this isn't the case where you actually see some transaction or hear a transaction. It's because the video and audio simply don't pick up. There's a gap. There's something missing. And it's not that it was because Mr. Harris was clever and used some kind of code. It was simply because the recordings didn't pick up everything.
Come up and hand him $250 and... know what you're going to get in return, right? You wouldn't even have to say anything.
I mean, that's their argument. I think finally the prejudicial impact. The government claims there wasn't a great prejudicial impact here, but I think the prejudicial impact was highlighted by the closing argument, where the focus was less on the transactions at issue and more on Mr. Harris's alleged occupation as a drug dealer. The government constantly refers to him as a drug dealer, refers to his drug business, his drug money, cars that he bought because of his drug business, and the very end of their closing, they six times refer to him as he is a drug dealer, he is a drug dealer, he is a drug dealer, and then admit that's, quote, that's what this evidence related to. There was a substantial amount of evidence here dealing with crime or alleged crimes that had nothing to do with the case, and they went towards... sold drugs on these occasions. He must have sold them this time, which is improper.
Do you think it would be helpful if you were given an opportunity to provide a supplemental briefing on the sentencing issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 weeks. You have something in, and maybe a week after that, you could do a reply.
Yes.
All right. That'll be on the sentencing issues that we discussed.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. And also, Mr. Rooney, you took this as an appointment by the court, for the court. And again, thank you very much for your excellent work and what will be continuing work, I guess.